Hi, I'm Fred Grandy.
And I'm Jill Whelan.
And I'm Ted Lange.
And you're listening to
Life Minute TV.
Hi, guys. I'm here with three of the cast of one of the most beloved shows of all time. Certainly one of my favorites, The Love Boat. Fred Grandy, Jill Whelan, and Ted Lange are here. They're starring in a new off-Broadway show here in town, written and directed by Ted, called Lady Patriot. So good to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be had.
Thank you.
So tell us about Lady Patriot.
It's a Civil War story. It's a play I wrote a couple of years ago. And it's a true story about a young black slave girl named Mary Bowser. And there was a woman named Elizabeth Van Loo, who Jill Whelan is playing. And Elizabeth Van Loo puts the slave girl into Jeff Davis's White House.
She sends her to Philadelphia to get her education.
Right. She puts her in the house and she's a spy. So this play examines her patriotism as a spy. It examines Elizabeth Van Loo's patriotism as a Southern lady who did not want to secede from the Union. And it examines the patriotism of Jeff Davis's wife, Verena Davis, who was the First Lady of the Confederacy. And so it's a kind of a triangulation of the point of view of who is a patriot, really.
And what about Fred's character?
I play Mary Bowser. It was...
No. He's playing the only Northerner in the piece.
Well, everybody in this play has a historical precedent, except for my character, who's a journalist who writes for the New York Tribune, which was the most prominent newspaper in the country at that point, Horace Greeley's paper. And, of course, very anti-slavery and secession. The guy I play is essentially coming in the second act to interview prominent people, and he also works with Elizabeth Van Loo in terms of taking confidential information that Mary Bowser has pilfered from the Jefferson Davis household, and then he turns it over to the Union. Although he's not based on a real character, when I was researching the history in the play, I found there were two reporters for the Herald Tribune, both of whom not only covered the war, but were caught and imprisoned in Confederate prisons. And so I kind of based who I was on those two guys.
Would you say it's a little bit funny?
There is humor. You'd be surprised that we could find some humor in the situation, but we do. Jill is so wonderful in this part. Her timing, you don't realize it when you're doing a TV sitcom, but when you start to do a straight play, you start to see the technique and the gravitas of your fellow actor. And that's Jill. Jill is just absolutely wonderful.
Well, you guys were my teachers. That's where I learned from these guys.
But they dropped all charges. So.
Yeah, there's humor in the play. So it's entertaining, but at the same time, it's informative. And you'll find out things you never knew about the Civil War. And that was on purpose because I dug up information. I call myself a footnote historian. And what I do is I go through books based on the time period, and I try to find things that people don't know about or might be surprised about, and then work them into the play.
I think it's interesting, too, that you kind of all, you do a lot of this period piece history, and you all have a little bit of, you know, political, especially you, background. Tell us about that. You do, too. Nancy Reagan's ambassador.
Oh, yeah.
No, I find that interesting.
We never discuss politics.
Yeah, we discussed politics, and then we went, what?
Yes, then we decided not to discuss
politics. Then we said, okay, we'll leave that alone.
The reality is he is as far to the left as I am to the right, and she just wobbles back and forth.
That is not true.
I think what we share is a commonality in that we are all passionate people. And we are passionate about our beliefs, and we're passionate about, you know, our morals, and we're passionate Americans. So I think that thread runs through all of us. But the difference is we have an immense respect for each other, and that trumps everything.
Trumps. You had to say it.
I did.
You had
God,
to say it.
I'm
but
so
see,
sorry.
Here's the thing.
I taught her to say that.
We can talk to each other. And it, like the good old days where, you know, people used to talk to you and say, okay, well, I respectfully disagree. Or, yes, I respectfully disagree.
People don't respectfully disagree anymore.
No,
they
man.
Come to blows almost immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's what's so interesting about it, because this is very reminiscent about the time of the play, which is when politicians back during the seceding of the Union, their lives were being threatened. Today, people are being threatened with being primaried, and I think some of them's lives are being threatened as well. But it's very similar. It's like, you know, it's a very cyclical thing. Human nature is what it is. So if you come see the play, you will see so many parallels to kind of where we are today, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah. My hairs are sticking up.
Yeah.
That's beautiful that, because you're right, you can't talk today. It's terrible.
No.
So that's great. That's great. What inspired you to do this?
I had a poker buddy. His name is Jack Kaplan. And Jack Kaplan gave me a book on Elizabeth Van Loo, who was a Southern lady Yankee spy. Isn't that the name of the book?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he gave me the book. He said, Ted, why don't you read this book? And he and I would always talk about playwriting. And so about 3 months went by, and we're at the poker game. And he said, hey, Ted, did you read the book? I go, no, Jack, I've been doing this. Then another 3 months go by. He said, did you read the book? No, not yet. And then another 3 months, and he says, hey, you haven't read about Mary Bowser in this book? I said, who's Mary Bowser? And then he tells me about this black slave girl that was a spy. And I said, Jack, why didn't you tell me before? And he said, well, I wanted you to think you discovered it. So I then sat down, read it, and then I saw the play immediately. That was the fascinating thing. I saw the play. I knew that it had to be about the three ladies. And then I started branching off to other Civil War books that would support the telling of the story.
Very neat. How is he as a director?
Oh.
Impossible.
He is an actor's director for obvious reasons, but the thing about Ted that I love so much is he doesn't lead with ego as a director. You know, he's got his ideas and things when he's writing, putting things on a page. And I think, especially when you are the writer as well, you have so much ownership that when it comes to watching other people try to interpret what you're doing, I think it's probably really hard to give that baby up to a group of people and let them figure out what to do with it in their own interpretations, but he's so good at that, and he makes it a very safe place for people to be able to, as I call it, the Easter egg hunt during rehearsals, to explore and define little moments and little things, and he's just, it's a wonderful free space to be when we work with him.
I trust them also. See, this is the thing, because I used to direct him on Love Boat and stuff like that, I trust them implicitly. So, like, Fred, we did a gig. Where were we, Mississippi?
Yeah.
When? The gambling
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, the yeah. So yeah. Fred comes up to me and says, I have to talk to you about the script. Now, usually when an actor says that to the director, the guy goes, oh, man, oh, no. But he has good ideas.
So don't tell him that.
It's too late now. So he said, I have to talk to you about the script. I said, okay, yeah, sure. He said, well, we're going to have breakfast together. Oh, no, no, no. So we sat down, we had breakfast again. He has wonderful ideas. And so it layered the story so that we discovered new things. Now, I did this play years ago, but it's not the same play. It's a different play because actors find things. Jill found some stuff and she called me up. Hey, what do you think of this? Great idea. You know, so I'm going to take credit for it. They did the work.
Should.
Everyone in the cast is my friend. So as a director, I'm being supported by the cast. And they are absolutely wonderful. I have Christy Ferris, who's playing Mary Bowser. I have Gordon Goodman, who's playing Jeff Davis. They were in the original production. And then I've got other people like Derek Powell.
The guy we discovered in Syracuse.
Yeah, we found, he was in Inherit the Wind with us, you know. And I got a guy.
Josie?
Josie DiVincenzo, who I've known for 40 years, she's just wonderfully talented. And Count Stovall, who I started out with in the San Francisco Bay Area. We were doing theater in the Bay Area back in the 60s, you know, the 70s. It's really great because you don't have the same kind of sometimes obstacles that you would with somebody you don't know as an actor, because they trust me. And so it cuts away a lot of stuff.
It's a shorthand. And
you get right to the heart of a scene. It makes it you want to go to work. And then you're going to see it manifest itself on stage. You know, and I am just in heaven with this production because I get to work with my friends.
An intimate both ways. Yeah. Love it, love it. Excellent, guys.
One of the interesting things about this trio is it's not uncommon for people who have worked together on a television show to get together periodically. It's almost unprecedented for people like us to work constantly together. This is the third show that Ted and I have. Actually, I take that back. It's the fourth show, but he's directed three of them. And we brought Jill in when we did I'm Not Rappaport in Michigan. And we had not seen her act since she was 11. So, and that's something of a risk, you know, because as you, I'm sure you've seen, not all kid actors grow up to be successful adult actors. As a matter of fact, the exception is the rule. So we brought her into the show. She was absolutely marvelous. And
they played father, daughter.
Yeah.
And they were wonderful together.
Yeah. I mean, it was a total change from her and Gavin McLeod, because she had a father who was too good to be true, and then she had a father who was too true to be good. But that ensemble is alive and well and recurs constantly. I can't think of another cast that does that.
Now, this is a limited time 12 performance run, September 6th to the 20th. So hurry and get your tickets at theaterrow.org.
Now I'm going to pitch our podcast. All right.
Okay.
I'm going to do that.
Go ahead.
We are going to be doing a podcast, which Princess Cruises will sponsor and is actually produced by my son, who is second generation Love Boat. And we're going to essentially find a lot of the old people that have done the show and interview them and catch up with them and talk about some of the
their experience.
Some of the experiences backstage and below decks, if you please.
Yes.
Below the waterline.
No, I mean, but that's another example of the three of us kind of cooperating and collaborating together.
That's fantastic. And it is beautiful. You have such a chemistry.
Well, the other problem is nobody else will work with us. So there is that.
Well, we just get along really well. I mean, I don't know of another show that lived in such tight quarters as we did when we would take cruises together. So you better figure out a way to get along. And we just, it's been a family. We were so lucky.
Yeah, we are a family.
Yeah.
We are a family.
Still to this day.
Yeah.
Do you still keep in touch with?
Yep.
Oh, constantly.
All of us. We loved each other.
We just did a play. The three of us did a play in Dexter, the one that Fred was referring to.
Yeah.
I'm Not Rappaport. We did a play in Michigan. And Lauren Twees, who played Julie McCoy, flew out and stayed with us.
She lives in Seattle.
Yeah,
she came to see us in Michigan.
Yeah.
I did Taming of the Shrew with Twees because I was always talking about Shakespeare. And then someone offered me Petruchio in a production of Taming of the Shrew. And then they said, who do you want? And I said, let's get Twees. And so we got Twees and we did the play in Reno. It was a lot of fun. And then I have another play that I had written about George Washington, another historical play, and it had Bernie Coppell in it. So, yeah, we are united.
It's kind of a traveling repertory company now. It's evolved from just being, you know, the cast of a hit show.
Yeah, it's fantastic. What do you think it was about that show that is so iconic? Did you know at the time as you were doing it how special it was going to be? Or
not right at first. There were three attempts at Love Boat, two of which failed miserably. The first one, none of us were in, the first pilot.
I don't think I knew that.
They threw out the actors and kept the boat.
Yeah.
That's what I like to say.
And then in the second one, Ted and Bernie and I were in it, but it still didn't go because they had a different captain, they had a different cruise director.
Yeah. Huh.
And then Aaron came in as the co-executive producer with this fellow Douglas Kramer, who had really conceived the show. And once that happened, I think there was a lock, because at the time, ABC was known as Aaron's Broadcasting Company. And Fred Silverman, who was the president of the network, and Aaron were very tight. And so we shot a third pilot, and we were picked up almost immediately.
Well, they didn't want it. They told Doug Kramer, we don't want this. And then Aaron made a phone call.
Yeah. So they did it really as a favor to Aaron Spelling.
Because yes.
he was such a prolific producer for them and had all of these hits like, you know, Charlie's Angels,
Rookies.
Starsky and Hutch and Rookie.
Mod Squad.
And so they said, we really have to do this for Aaron. And then, of course, the show almost instantaneously climbed to the top of the ratings.
Yeah, it was
And the
top
critics
five.
Were stunned.
Yeah,
and,
top five.
And horrified.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. And we stayed up there for like 5 years. We were always in the top five. And so he did have the Midas touch, because he, for whatever reason, he had an eye that he saw the talent and put us together.
He knew what the public wanted to see.
Yeah.
He really did have a talent for that.
And we had chemistry, and he saw the chemistry that we had. Mm-hmm. And that was amazing. That was amazing that he could do that.
The only guy that really believed in the show from the outset was Gavin McLeod. The rest of us had to be convinced, because we'd all done flops.
I remember this was before the cruise industry changed. So it used to be elderly people on a boat with their last hurrah. And so I remember Fred and I having a conversation going, nobody's going to buy this, because we looked at the reality of the situation. But our show brought in young people, beautiful people, single people, and that started to reflect itself in reality. So our show kind of changed the perception of what taking a cruise was all about.
Well, Princess Cruises, when we first started, had three ships. Actually, two ships and a yacht, really. And the largest capacity was 783 passengers, and that was considered a big ship. Now, they have 18 ships, and they're about 3,500 passengers.
Wow.
All right, so the ship that we were on could fit inside the ship that we work on now when we go out and do these reunion cruises. But you know, to answer your question, the reason that show survives and the reason it was a hit is because it made you feel good. And there is not much television, if any, that does that now. And it sustains. It creates a kind of communal family atmosphere that people remember well into adulthood. You know, they remember watching the show with their grandparents, or they remember watching the show with their girlfriend or something like that.
Well, so, and you know what I think is, if you turn on the TV and you see just a scene, it's hard to turn away. You watch the rest of the episode. You can't help it.
I think the through line that we get from everybody when they come, and we do reunion cruises, we're doing one in November with Princess Cruises, is they all say the same thing. This was the show that I could watch with my parents or my grandparents, and we would all be riveted for different reasons. But it reminds me, as Fred was talking about, it reminds me of family, because that's what it was. And I think at the time, you know, it started in 77, and it was just after a recession. Not everybody had
gas lines
and all of that stuff. And Jimmy Carter, and he was president at the time, and, mm-hmm. and nobody could afford really to travel. And this was a form of armchair travel that was... We addressed the fantasies of, I think, a lot of people in this country of going to these foreign places, Egypt and China and all
Greece.
Of Asia
Greece
and Spain and France. And I think that for a lot of people, this was an opportunity to fantasize about things that are wonderful and know that at least by the end of the show, everything was going to be wrapped up in a bow and it would be a happy ending. You didn't have to think too much. It was just fun, and you got to see all of these old iconic celebrities.
And she's talking about the civilian response. These were people sitting at home and watching the show. But we've learned, just as we've started this podcast, there were a lot of people that we knew in the business. For example, Jimmy Walker, who became a huge star on Good Times. But he loved to do our show because he always felt more comfortable in our ensemble than he did in his own. Yeah. There's always, almost always, a lot of tension on shows that are trying to become hits, and actors, whether they will admit it or not, are competing with one another. And you have to, because sometimes you get cut from the team.
Well, and it depends. See, I remember we had a couple of people that came in like this our show, you know, and then we would say, hey, we're doing comedy, you know, relax, enjoy yourself. And it took them like 2 days. Then all of a sudden they're saying, hey, I'm not fighting. No, you're not. Relax, enjoy yourself. And then and part of that came from Gavin McLeod. He taught Fred and I particularly because we weren't exactly.
We were uppity.
Yeah, we were.
We were both uppity.
Yeah, yeah.
I learned it from him, but I was uppity.
But he taught us the thing of being a gracious host because that's what he was. And he'd been in show business longer than us. And him and Bernie came to us, sat me and Fred down and said, hey, this is how this works. You know, welcome the people on. Show them where craft service
is.
This is our
welcoming
home.
Welcoming people to your home.
They're coming into your house.
And it also came from above. I mean, we did an interview with Juliet Mills, who holds the record for the most guest shots on Love Boat. And at one point, Aaron Spelling did a wonderful thing, unlimited generosity. He flew her father, John Mills, and her sister, Haley Mills, to Beverly Hills at Christmas time so they could all do a Love Boat together.
Yeah.
Remember? She talked about that,
yes.
And you said he didn't have to do that, but he volunteered to do that. So when that word gets out in Hollywood and people say, wow, you want to talk about a safe space, you ought to do that show. Now, the other side of that is there was a certain amount of perhaps Hollywood snobism and contempt about our show perhaps not being quite as
hip.
Heady.
As hip and as popular with the critics as, say, a MASH or a Hill Street Blues or some of the ones that usually wound up winning all the Emmys. But we were the popular hit. We became a very popular
this
hit
popular
with
show,
the players in Hollywood as well, because when they came on our show, they knew it was a safe space, they were going to have fun, and the world was going to watch it. And every so often, they'd get a cruise.
Yeah,
so
that was
one
of the lures.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, we had people that we brought back that hadn't worked in a long time. And I remember Howard Keel coming on our show, and he was rusty, you know? And he did a scene, and they said, cut, print, and he walked off, and he went like this. I said, are you all right? He said, that wasn't it. That wasn't it. I said, well, tell the director you want to do it again. He goes, no, 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 you can't do that. You can't do that. And then a day later, he got his rhythm back. And so when they said, cut, print, he was like this.
Aww.
Yeah, that was it. I got it back.
Aww.
You know, so it was fun like that. And then Fred and I, we started a thing called the Goldwyn Club, where we would take the older Hollywood actors out to lunch.
Like Ray Bolger, Jack Gilford, people like that.
Yeah, and we would say, we'd buy them lunch, and then we'd sit at the table and say, tell us what happened when you were doing this or doing that. You know, and you would get great stories.
Oh, I bet.
Great Hollywood stories that aren't in any of the books. You
Who
know?
Were some of your other favorites? There's so many.
Oh my gosh, there were over 1,000 guest stars, so it's so hard to pick.
I was very lucky to do a summer tour on stage with Don Ameche, who did How to Succeed in Business together. And Don, you may not know his career, but he was a huge star in the late 40s and then just kind of disappeared. Came to New York for a while and then, as he said, I was doing a lot of summer stock in the winter. And he and I did this play together, and it was unjust in a way because I was billed above him. And I grew up watching Don Ameche. But then he wound up doing our show, and then he got Trading Places and Cocoon, and he wins an Oscar.
Yeah.
And there was that kind of feeling of regenerating yourself on this show.
Yes.
And it happened a lot. Mary Martin. Helen Hayes.
That's what Howard Keel went to Dallas after doing our show.
Right.
Lonnie Anderson went to WKRP.
Yeah.
So Tom Hanks
yeah.
played your friend.
Lonnie Anderson did our show before she was even a guest star.
Yeah.
I mean, she was just in the back of the crawl at the end of the show.
And then she came on as a star.
Yeah. No.
Later, a couple years later.
Aaron was like the Quentin Tarantino.
He was.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Fun.
Amazing. Awesome. And you were so young. You must have learned a lot from these guys.
So much from these guys. I mean, honestly, that is where I've learned any kind of comedic timing, any kind of discipline in our industry. Everything I know, I learned from these guys. And I'm grateful to have had that experience. Because as much as Fred was alluding to the fact that the show was maybe not as well respected within the industry, the respect for these actors individually and as a group is incredible for anybody who's worked with them and who knows
them. And this may be the last interview she did. We did an interview with Loretta Swit for our podcast. And, you know, Loretta was a big star on MASH. And MASH was just around the corner for us when we were
shooting
at 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
And she came on our show. And the image that she conveyed on MASH was so different from what she did on our show. And she was one of those people who just loved being in our ensemble.
Yeah.
And she did a couple of shows. She did a wonderful show with Bernie where she played a Soviet cruise ship commissar. And it was a wonderful show. And so people would come on this show and they'd get to play. And the pressure would be off.
And see, this is the thing about, people don't know really what a fine actor he is because they're locked in Love Boat. But he did Harry Truman.
He directed it.
Clarence Darrow.
He directed it.
You know, so I know what he can do. So if I go to him and I say, listen, I'd like you to be in my play, would you grow a mustache? And he does, you know, and I go to Jill.
He asked me to grow a mustache too.
And so I go to Jill because I know what they can deliver.
How long did each Love Boat episode take?
7 days.
7 days.
And you six really days. Days.
6 days?
Six yes. Days.
Well, maybe
six
they made
an hour
oh,
show
I worked
in
an
six
extra
days.
Day. That's right. No kidding. Six
and
days.
You actually
we had to go
went
to
on cruises?
That's true.
You guys actually cruised?
We shot 10 pages a day. That's unheard of.
Now.
Yes, it's unheard of. But
now.
But we, and really one of the skills that you learned on the show was to be fast and funny and make your point and get off the stage.
And efficient. You had to, there was an efficiency that you had to have. Fred and I, sometimes we would get a script and there'd be some things in it that weren't quite right. So we would go either his dressing room, my dressing room, and we'd go, hey, and we'd read the scene, and then we would find other things.
Now, one of the nice things about that was because we were turning out 3 stories a week per show, there was an A story, a B story, and a C story. And the writers were beleaguered at all times because they kept having to turn out this product. So when we would come up with an idea to close out a scene that maybe made it a little funnier or a little tighter, they almost always responded positively. You wouldn't get that on a lot of other shows because the writers would be very defensive about their work.
Yeah.
But these guys were so overworked and underpaid probably that when we could in some ways make the scene a little tighter, a little better, they said, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And so we got a chance to do things on our show that you wouldn't normally get to do. And simply it was because we were always playing beat the clock.
But yeah. I also think that's a tribute to how much you respect the craft, because it wasn't just, oh, I'm not worrying about it. I'm just going to go and hit my mark, say my lines and forget about it. It was always about how to make it better, how to make it funnier, how to make it entertaining for not just the people watching, but for us as actors to spend our day with how we spend our time. And to answer your question, yes, we did travel. We did. We did 3 cruises a year for 6 weeks or something at a time.
It depended. You know, we started out going to Mexico, which was the standard Princess run. And then as the show began to become popular, they went up to Alaska, which was another
Princess route. That was our first, other than Mexico, that was our first deal with
going
to Alaska.
And then as the show really began to enter the stratosphere of hits, then they started taking us to places like Australia and eventually China. But Princess didn't have the ships to do that then. Now they do. So we were on other cruise lines for many of the episodes that now are the two-hour movies that you'll see from time to time, like in the Mediterranean or in the Northern Sea, for in Copenhagen or somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And you guys both directed a couple of them,
I didn't
too,
direct.
Right?
I wrote a bunch of them.
Oh, you wrote?
But,
okay,
but he directed.
Well, you know what happened is we were doing the show, and I was kind of getting short shrifted in the love
kind
stories.
Kind of getting short shrifted.
No.
Please, can I have some more?
And so Fred and Bernie went to the producer and says, hey, we have an idea for a storyline for Ted. And they went, thank God. Yeah, you write it. Go ahead.
Yeah.
And write it.
Leave us alone. Go write it.
Yeah. And so they wrote a story for me, you know. And the other thing was I really wanted to direct. And I had gone to the American Film Institute to study film directing. I kept going. Every year I would go, the first year, second year, third year, fourth year. I'd say, can I direct an episode? No, 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 no. And eventually it came around to the point where we renegotiated the contract because they signed us to a five-year contract instead of a seven-year contract. So they didn't want to negotiate in our fifth year because we would have put a gun to their head and said more money. So they negotiated with the fourth year, and I said, I want to direct. That's what I want to do. And I was very fortunate because they supported me. The cast, Tweez, everybody supported me, and they knew I wanted to direct. And they saw some of the other directors, and they said, man, let's get at least get Ted in
Be
there.
Be kind.
I mean, come on. You know, that kicked off my directing career.
You've directed so many things. Tell us about them.
Yeah, well, you know what? I got drunk with Lee Majors in Hong Kong.
My other favorite.
Yeah, oh, and he says, hey, we were kind of smashed. And he said, hey, you direct, don't you? I go, yeah, I direct. He says, well, why don't you direct me on Fall Guy? Oh, yeah, okay, I can direct you on Fall Guy. He said, if you get into trouble, I'll help you. And I said, I'm not going to get into trouble, because we were a little tipsy. I said, I'm not going to get into trouble. Don't worry, it'll be fine. So that also kicked it off. But I started doing a lot of different TV shows like Mike Hammer and Fall Guy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Moesha,
that's right. That was, yes, that's right.
Yeah, and, I think a lot of people know that.
I have fun. My thing is I can see the joke. Well, sometimes when the actor can't see the joke, I can see where they want to go, but they're uncertain, and I give them the thing to go. No, try this. And because, first of all, I love actors, and I love seeing them achieve, you know, and get the joke. I directed Bob Urich. He did a reboot of Love Boat. And I'll never forget, he was a little bit gun-shy with comedy. And so I said, hey, Bob, why don't you try this? He says, no, I don't want to try that. And I said, okay. So I gave it to one of the girls that were playing a cruise director. And then we did a second, and said, hey, Bob, why don't you try this? And he goes, no. So I gave it to another girl. And each time the crew laughed. So the third time I said it to him, he said, Ted, do you really think that's funny? And I said, Bob, if it's not funny, we won't do it. Try it. He tries it. And what I did, the producer came to me and said, what'd you do to Bob Urich? So what do you mean? What do you mean? He said, well, he's usually in his trailer. He never comes out and stands on the set. And he would stand on the set and he'd say, what do you think of this joke? And I go, good idea. And so It's that kind of enthusiasm for the work that I try, hopefully, to give to actors so that they feel free to call me up and say, we need to have breakfast because I got some I got some ideas for your show.
That's great. Theater and TV, what are the differences?
TV, and I don't think I'm being cynical about this, but most people do television for the money. Because if you're successful in television, that underwrites very often the work you really want to do. Which in my case, and I think I speak for my two colleagues here, is live theater. And live theater has been imperiled in the last 5 years, certainly throughout the COVID epidemic. I can't tell you the number of theaters that closed. You know, now we tend to watch programs on our cell phones or on our iPads, and we're closing ourselves off into a virtual reality. You can't do that with live theater. You have to be in the audience. You have to pay attention. You have to convey to the audience why it is they're there. And it's one of the few places still left in drama where you have to tell a story. To me, and pretty much all I do now is live theater, because I'm at a point in my life where that's to me what acting is about. It's about the people, the part, and the play. And if you get two of those three, great. If you get three of those three, you're gold. You don't get that feeling in television, at least I never did. And I think that's one of the reasons that I now try and do projects that I can put in front of an audience. I look at another generation coming up, and I'm not sure they're as keen to come to the theater as we are.
Jill, you do singing as well as drama in the theater, mm-hmm. as well as comedy on TV, so.
Well, I mean, the thing I love about the theater, because that's where I started too, was theater. It's where I cut my teeth. Most people probably think our favorite thing is when the performance happens. It's not for me. My favorite thing is rehearsal, because rehearsal is like an Easter egg hunt. That's where you can try things out and find new things. You get to do it. It's a luxurious experience, because in television, you get maybe one, two rehearsals and you got to move on, and you got to move on to the next. And that's when you go home that night and you're like, damn, I could have done this, but it's done. It's in the can. It's too bad. Dailies are tomorrow, and it's over.
Cut, print.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
But cut it, print it, ship it.
That's it. But with theater, you do all of this Easter egg hunting, and then you do it in front of an audience, and you see whether or not you got the golden egg. And if you didn't get the golden egg, you get to come back tomorrow and do it all over again and try something different. And it's such a freeing experience, and it's just the best form of acting that I understand.
What's your favorite way to travel?
First class.
Absolutely.
Hey, first class. Yeah.
What's something you never travel without?
I never travel without some kind of a book, because reading calms me down. Reading helps me relax at night. And it also makes me feel as though I'm learning something without really trying. It doesn't really matter what book it is, but I always have to travel with a book.
Excellent.
And it's not a book about theater, usually.
I never travel without creating an opportunity where I have no plan. Because I think as much as I plan a trip out, and that's a wonderful thing to do and it's important, I think following your nose in a place that you don't really know creates so much opportunity to discover things that you never even knew you were going to find. And I love that. I love being able to find little out-of-the-way places.
Like Zingerman's in Ann Arbor.
Oh, yes.
You know what
Boy.
Zingerman's is? It's the best delicatessen in the world. You'd think it'd be in this city. It's in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Yes. Yeah.
It's sandwiches the size of your head.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just remember one day my sister and I, we were in Italy, and we never planned that day. We were in Genoa, and we just went down this little tiny street, and we found a restaurant, and it was, believe me, not something that you'd say, well, that looks like a place to go. But when we looked inside, it was like hospital green cement paint. That's kind of what it was. And above the balcony above, they had their laundry hanging over. But we looked inside, and every single person inside was a local. And every single person inside, you could tell, was, you know, a worker or what have you. And it was packed with people. And we went in there and we sat down. There was no English spoken. There were men outside playing chess, sitting on, you know, wooden stumps. And it was some of the best pesto I've ever had in my life. And there was no sign out front. But I mean, it's those little experiences that you find. And I think that's important, to always leave your option open to discover something that was not originally in your agenda.
Excellent.
I always travel with more underwear than I need. I'm serious. Man, you never know what's going to happen, what kind of emergency is going to be there. So
you listened to your mother.
Yes, I did. Clean underwear.
That's right.
That's it.
What's your favorite cocktail?
White Russian, which he always gives me grief about.
He eats them before dinner. He drinks those things before dinner.
I love them.
It's like a milkshake.
Is he actually a good bartender?
He's a certified bartender.
Yeah.
You really did.
No, he went to bartender school.
Yeah.
Before you did the Love Boat?
No, in the middle of, if you watch the first year of Love Boat, you can tell I knew nothing about mixing a drink because every drink was in a blender and had an umbrella. So then I went to bartending school and I learned how to free pour. I learned how to cut lemons and limes and all of that because I said, well, maybe this thing is going to go on and I better learn
how. You just did that on your own volition.
Oh, yeah, wow. Yeah. Well, they gave me two diplomas. They gave me a diploma as Isaac Washington and they gave me a diploma as Ted Lange. They said, well, you're an actor. If the gig doesn't pan out, you can always use this.
All right, Isaac, you've given a lot of advice on the show. What's the best advice you've ever gotten?
I talked to Gene Kelly. Oh. Gene Kelly, in case you don't know, he was a big...
Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, singing in the Rain.
Deal.
He is kind of a big deal. And he said, cash your check as soon as you get it.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I mean...
He was on the show, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, he was in Hong Kong with us.
Yeah, that's where I got the advice. He was on the show. They told us, they said, Gene Kelly is kind of a grumpy guy. Don't talk to him. Leave him alone. And he and I were in Hong Kong, and we're waiting. We're sitting on a minibus waiting to go to the set. And I said, I don't care if he is a grumpy guy. I'm going to go and talk to this guy. So I went and talked. I sat down in front of him, and I said, can I ask you a question? And he was reading a magazine. Can I ask you a question? And Gene Kelly's like this. You want to ask me a question? And I go, yeah. And so, I don't know, I guess he saw my enthusiasm or whatever. He said, what's the question? I said, what was it like dancing with the Nicholas Brothers? And I don't think he ever got that question. He always got a Singing in the Rain question. And for those of you that don't know, the Nicholas Brothers were two black tap dancers that were in stormy weather. And they danced with Gene Kelly. And so he gave me a wonderful story about dancing with them. And so we go, we leave, and we go shoot our scene. And then after the scene, he says, hey, can I buy you a drink back at the hotel?
Aww.
I go, yeah. And so he and I, we went back to the hotel, and we sat up. And that's when he started giving me show business advice. We're sitting, drinking, and having fun. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So cash your check right away.
Cash your check as soon as you get it, because you never know.
Okay. What about you, Fred? Your character gave a lot of advice, too, on the show. What's the best advice you've ever...
It was only bad advice.
What's the best advice you've ever gotten and that you would want to give out?
Trust in the Lord and not in your own understanding, which is something I have learned from my wife and is something I wish I knew when I was on the show.
How so? What do you mean?
I think I relied on my own understanding too much, which is usually misunderstanding. So it's taken me a while, but I think I've kind of got that worked out now.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. What's your ideal romantic gesture?
Hey, right here.
Or you think of any better questions, love related?
Yeah.
Well, I think.
Love advice.
Finally, after the third time, got it right. And I think for me, the reason that I got it right is that I finally realized that if you are not completely yourself when you meet somebody, you know, no trying to be something else or trying to, you know, pretend something and put on airs or whatever, when you're finally able to say, this is who I am, and you either take it or leave it. That is when you find the person that you're meant to be with. And when that happens, the most romantic gesture to my husband and me is that we can just sit together on the couch and hold hands Doesn't matter whether we're in a restaurant, it doesn't matter whether we're at home sitting on the couch. Just that time when we can be together, and that's everything. And everything is a romantic gesture when that happens.
If you're comfortable in the silence,
yeah,
that usually spells a successful relationship.
Yeah.
You know what I like to do is I tell my wife I love her when...
You've had a white Russian.
No, yeah. No. Well, yeah, that is true. But I tell her when it's not an obvious moment.
Yes.
You know, just like she'll do something, just a little something for me. I'll thank her and I'll tell her I love her. Yeah. And I didn't do that the first time around. I expected certain things the first time around. And what I found is the fact that I can say to her when she does something, you know, little, it doesn't have to be a good thing. Like she'll bake a potato and I'll say, hey, man, I love this. I love you. Thank you. You know, and she goes, but I just baked your potato. I know.
She unpacks his underwear after a trip.
Yeah. All his underwears.
But no, I think you should tell the person you're married to when they least expect it. Tell them that you love them.
That's a good one. That's good. I have to just ask you. You were on Airplane.
Yes.
Iconic.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Oh, it was incredible. It was it was such an interesting way that they shot it. I was only there for 2 weeks and I was little, so I don't have quite the memories that everybody else has, but just the way that they shot it, then the freedom that the actors were allowed to have to improv was pretty magical and incredible. Ethel Merman on the set, I happened to be there for that day when she came out of the bed and started singing, "Yo, be swell."
Oh, you do sing well. Leslie Nielsen.
Yes. Oh, well, Leslie was such a funny guy anyway. He was famous. I don't know if you know. He carried around a little whoopee cushion in his hand. And when we were promoting the show, we were in Canada and we got on an elevator and we were going up. And then this whole group of Japanese tourists, there was about 10 of them, got on the elevator with us. And they had pushed the 12th floor, and we were on the first floor. And they all get on the elevator with us, and he just looks at me, and he gets this grin on his face, and he squeezes the whoopee cushion. And they all got off on the second floor.
Fred, you've led a very interesting life, lost both your parents at a very young age. You went to Harvard.
Who does that?
And you've been a politician in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. What came first and how did you end up acting?
Oh, it was just being naughty as a kid. I mean, I was the third of three sons. And as a young kid, because I was the post-war child, I think I felt an enormous compulsion to entertain my mother at all times. And she was a pretty easy mark, to tell you the truth. I'm not sure what actually moved me into acting, except when I applied to law school, my law boards were lower than my bowling score. So that was an indication I might not want to move in that direction. I started out in improvisational theater, first in Boston and then down here in New York off-Broadway with people like Jane Curtin and Paul Kreppel and people like that. And it just
James Woods too, right?
Well, James Woods and I did a two character play together, but that wasn't an improv. I fell into it and just kept going. But I really found, and this is going to sound weird, but my love for live theater, I think, grew out more of the town meetings I used to do in Iowa when I was a politician, and I would go into these little towns, you know, 400 or 500 people, and 100 of them would show up at my town meeting and want to know what was going on in Washington. And I felt a tremendous compunction to tell them as honestly as I could what was going on and why I was doing what I was doing. They often didn't like it at all. But that was live theater. And I found much later on when I decided to get back into acting after my political career and my radio career and a couple of other things, that's what drove me back into the craft. Was getting in front of people, usually without a net, and performing. And so really that probably was the greatest acting experience I had, because it was just me. And he knows, because he directed me for a 90-minute play where it's me on stage all alone, just talking like Harry Truman. And if I had not done all those town meetings and had to stand and deliver time after time after time, I don't think I ever could have done that show.
Wow. That's so interesting.
He could have done it. He could have done it. He's being modest.
He is being modest.
And I'm so shocked to see that.
I know. What's happening?
Well, I can cut it out.
My mom was a secretary.
My mother was, she became a local San Francisco Bay Area TV personality. She started out as a secretary and then ended up working for the mayor of San Francisco. And then a TV company came into the San Francisco Bay Area and they needed someone who knew all of the political things that was going on. And they hired her, and then eventually, my mother's a talker, and they know I'm a talker, so now you know where I get it from, is my mother. So she ended up on television being one of the first black celebrities to have, and it was on PBS, to have a talk show, and she would do a lot of political. So in our house, there was a lot of politics spoken. So that's where I got it. My father was another great one for. My father loved to debate. And I'll never forget, I was telling my girlfriend, who became my first wife, I didn't want to introduce her to my father because my father was going to debate her no matter what she said. He was going to take one side or the other. And we used to sit, my brother and I used to sit at my father's feet, and he'd have these actors come over, and they would do anything to win an argument. They would make jokes, they would cry, they would use analogies and stuff like that. So we sat there, my brother and I sat there, and that's who I saw on the stage was, this was in the 50s, the 1950s, my father was an actor. So we would go to the theater with my dad. Now here's an interesting story. We went to theater with my dad to see him in a play. And they had us backstage, and my brother and I, we were talking in the middle of the performance. So my father was saying, shh. And I thought he was calling us. So I grabbed my brother's hand, got up, walked up on stage, and I said, come on, Mikey, Daddy wants us. And we walked across the stage, and you see these two hands come under the thing and yank these kids off. So after that show, Pearl Bailey came backstage and said, where are those two little boys and so-and-so, so-and-so? And we were introduced to Pearl Bailey. Years later, Pearl plays my mother on Love Boat.
On Love Boat, right.
Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of fun.
Wow. Full circle. You know, that's amazing.
You know, how can that even happen, you know?
What about you? How did you get into this whole thing? And
I'm also a Bay Area kid, born in Oakland as well. And my mom was a preschool director. And in the summertime, she didn't have a place that could handle me, you know, a creative place. So she'd bring me to work. But I would start trying. She'd say, okay, now it's Play-Doh time. And I would say, nope, now it's dress-up time. So that was not working for her. So she thought, I got to find something for this kid. And in the town over, place called Pleasanton, California, there was a community theater that was doing a production of The King and I. And she thought, oh, The King and I, that's good. That's good. There's a lot of kids. It'll be like summer camp. So she found the only voice teacher in town because they required a vocal audition. And she said, could you teach my kid a song? She said, I don't teach kids. She goes, I'm not asking you to teach her. I just give me a song. I don't know how to do that for her. So she ended up giving me a song and taking me on as a student, but she was also ended up was playing Anna in The King and I, and I became her student for years. I got that part, and a lot of those kids were doing commercials in San Francisco, and I said, I'd
Brebner.
Like to do that. Yes!
See?
And see, you know.
I know,
Ann Brebner. That's right.
Right.
And so the kids, I said, how do you do that? And they said, well, send your school picture into this agency that we go to and see what happens. So I took my school picture, sent it into the agency. My mom gets a phone call. Hello, this is the Brebner Agency. We'd like to see your daughter. And she said, why do you have her? Why do you have her information? She said, I don't know, but we have this school picture and a letter written by your daughter. And so my mother asked me about it. And I said, yes, I sent that in. So I ended up doing commercials. And then that voice teacher had a friend who was in L.A., who she said to her L.A. friend, who was an actress, you got to get this kid into L.A. You got to. So I ended up doing an audition for Annie, the musical, and I got that part. And I had, there was a talent scout there from Aaron Spelling who said, can she come in and audition for a TV show we're doing? I got both things. I had to choose which one, and I chose the television show, which was why I was able to guest star on Love Boat. And when my show didn't go, he brought me back on Love Boat. So that's how that all happened.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, when a trajectory is meant to happen, yeah. It is what it is. And you just got to put your seatbelt on and
Absolutely.
And ride that ride,
that's
baby.
That's right.
What are you guys binge watching? What are your favorite shows to watch?
We just watched the other night. It was really good.
Hostages.
Ooh. That was really good. That was really good. Bad Sisters, amazing.
Well, we liked Bad Sisters because we were all in Michigan watching that. My wife and I love Shetland, the British mystery with Douglas Henshall, one of the great TV detectives of all time.
I have to watch that.
And there's a lot of competition.
What is it on, Netflix?
The Gentleman.
No, it's usually on BritBox, or I think it may be on Prime.
No, I'm not exactly sure.
But they're like six or seven seasons.
Oh, wow, that's good.
And they shoot it up in the Shetland Islands.
Yeah. You know what else is good is Slow Horses. Is really
oh, I love
good.
Slow Horses.
Slow Horses.
Yeah, yes. No, that's Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
No, it's good.
Yeah.
Gosh, I have to catch up. I'm still on, I'm doing Landman right now, which is pretty
good. Oh, Landman's good.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah, Taylor Sheridan, what a good writer.
Yes.
Yellowstone.
You know?
Yellowstone. Watching that.
Well, 1923.
Tulsa King.
1880.
Yeah. Doesn't he do Tulsa King?
Yeah. He's really, really good. Yeah. I like watching him to see the trend that his stories take. You know, because he always finds a way. He's a wonderful writer, and he knows the actors to choose to tell the story. And that's what I like doing. And that's why it's like we're doing Lady Patriot. I knew they were right for the story, you know. And that's, so the other thing I like to do is watch other directors and other writers. And like sometimes I'm with my wife and we're watching a show and I'll say, camera's in the wrong place. And she says, will you stop that? I said, no, but the guy should have moved the, you know. And then how they introduce a character on film is really important. So I like watching, and if it defines something about the character. So I like watching certain directors just to see how they introduce the character or how they write the story that benefits character.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, guys.
Oh, thank
awesome.
You.
Good
thank
luck
you
with
so
it.
Much.
Thank you.
To see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.